Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Now, if there was ever a workforce that fought and flew like none other over the past 20 years, no aircraft would match the record of the B-1. In the wake of the attacks of September 11th, when America and its allies launched Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, this aircraft was at the forefront of the action. The reason for this is simple. There were a few regional bases in the area, and the B-1's range and payload allowed it to conduct missions few other aircraft could match. This was especially important given how the tanker fleet was so stretched thin at the time, making the attributes of the B-1 invaluable. As the conflict evolved, the demand for the B-1 never declined. The kickoff of Operation Iraqi Freedom only caused the B-1's demand signal to grow even more. So this meant the B-1 community was flying combat missions on a nonstop basis for nearly two decades. This was far from easy, but the crews and the maintainers answered the call. So today we're talking about flying the B-1, one of America's most prolific bombers, with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Moses Kimball. He's flown the B-1 throughout his operational career and has commanded at the squadron level. We've also enjoyed having him here as one of our Air Force fellows over the past year at the Mitchell Institute. Well, Moses, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Slick. Glad to be here. I've really enjoyed listening to the last 20 plus episodes, so it's cool to be invited on as well.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine it's been that many. So let's begin with this. Let's start with a flying story. Can you tell us what it was like the first time you strapped into the B-1 and flew it? I don't think any of us forget the first day that we've flown our airplane.
Yeah, you're right. The first sortie is definitely memorable. For one, it was scheduled for 5 or 6 hours from the schoolhouse at Dyess to New Mexico and back. At that point, I think the longest sortie I'd ever flown was just under 2 hours in a T-38, and I certainly had never worn my helmet that long. Before you get to your first flight, we'd been doing B-1 academics and training in the simulators for, you know, three and a half months. So going on a little bit of a tangent, the B-1A was designed in the 70s for a high-level Mach 2 plus mission, somewhat like the XB-70 before it, and the advancement of radar-guided surface-to-air missiles led to a redesign for the B-1B before it entered production in the 1980s. The B model had some extensive modifications to optimize it for the low-level nuclear mission in those days. They would have used the terrain for radar masking, using defensive systems to detect and maneuver around the threats. So it was designed to have pretty good visibility out of the huge windscreen. Each pilot has matching controls, a right-hand stick and a left-hand throttle, not a shared central throttle like a civilian airliner. And the jet is pretty nimble and handles really well for an aircraft of its size. So to get to the point, during all the preparation in the sim, you're getting used to this good forward visibility. You're sitting way in front of the wings, and the similarity of the controls to the T-38 kind of lets you forget how big the jet is. So one particularly memorable surprise that day was pretty early in the pre-flight checklist, just simply moving the wings for the on-ground check. They're full of more than 30,000 pounds of fuel, and you can feel the whole jet, you know, rock back and forth on its landing gear. I kind of had this split second of like, oh crap, what did I break? The sim's pretty good for checklist procedures, but, you know, kind of masks some of those other sensations.
Man, that's incredible. It's something I never had to worry about flying the F-16. You know, when you're sitting at an air show or seeing the airplane on the ramp, it's just something you don't really think about. That's totally amazing.
Yeah. Another really impressive thing during that sortie was the jet's speed and acceleration with four afterburning engines. You're moving about 6 miles a minute just on departure out of the field.
All right, so putting this into context, you've got four F-110 engines underneath you. That's, for me, four F-16s, and you're sitting on it at that point of time. So from a propulsion standpoint, it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, at full AUG, you're burning hundreds of thousands of pounds of gas and pushing about 120,000 pounds of thrust. So then we get out to the training area. We're practicing evading threats. The handling of the jet's still pretty impressive for me as a young co-pilot. And one reason for that is its rolling tail, which is to say that not only does the horizontal stab combine the elevator into a single surface like most supersonic aircraft, but each side deflects asymmetrically to roll left or right. And those stabs are huge. Each side of the stab is about the size of an F-15's wing. So all of that, you know, combined, the sounds and sensations of this huge jet behind you when you're out there on the pointy end of it, really makes an impression, even after being in the sim.
Well, Moses, how old were you during that first flight?
I guess, so this would have been like 2005, so I would have been 25.
Right, so right out of college, you are in charge of this incredible airplane. Now, how'd your career progress from there?
Well, every new B-1 pilot and weapons systems officer, or WISO, starts their B-1 career at the formal training unit at Dyess. And then they go on to one of the combat squadrons for their first assignment. For me, that was to Ellsworth in the Black Hills of South Dakota. So like your conversation with Stutz a few weeks ago, it takes time to season a B-1 aviator. As a new co-pilot, you're taught that your first job is to learn as much as you can about the aircraft and its systems, how to fly it, and then you keep adding things to your plate. B-1 tactics, formation tactics, integrating with other air assets like at Red Flag, performing at these levels first as a co-pilot, then aircraft commander, and then upgrading to flight lead, mission lead, and eventually as an instructor.
Moses, give me a time horizon. Are we talking years for you to get this kind of seasoning, or how long does it take?
Yeah, so for me, these upgrades to aircraft commander, flight lead, and instructor took place at Ellsworth over a few years, a little over 3 years. And then after that, I was sent back to Dyess, now as an instructor at the formal training unit. From there, I went on my way to the weapons school, which for the B-1 community is hosted at Dyess as well. And, you know, as a former instructor there, I certainly don't have to tell you about the tactical expertise and leadership lessons from that school. I was then able to deploy from Dyess with the combat squadron there as the squadron weapons officer. Took a little detour out of the jet for a couple of years, and then I was lucky enough to come back and spend some time at Ellsworth as the director of operations and later commander of the 37th Bomb Squadron Tigers.
So if you look back on those years, what are some really formative memories that you have when you look back? And where did you really see yourself grow?
Well, I would say the big learning experiences or big growing experiences as a young aviator, you see those at major exercises, Red Flag, Green Flag, Northern Edge. Also on the combat deployments, I deployed 3 times to Al Udeid in my first 5 years flying the airplane. And building up that time and experience and those repetitions is where you gain a lot of that experience.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, can you walk us through what it's like to fly a combat mission?
Sure. So I'll caveat it with my experience has all been in OEF and OIF, and once those were kind of well-established operations. My first deployment was in 2007, so a very different experience than what the crews who had flown an Allied force in 1999 would have experienced. Desert Fox and Allied Force in 98 and 99, respectively, were the first combat missions for the B-1. And in those cases, they were taking the jet up against some relatively modern, though not quite cutting-edge, defensive systems from the former Soviet Union. I'm sure you and the listeners remember the shoot-downs of the F-117 and an F-16 that was piloted by a future CSAF. But there were also 6 MiG-29s that were shot down, and the B-1 crews were actually getting shot at by surface-to-air missiles basically every night. But none were hit, which was a testament to the jets' defensive suite and towed decoy.
Yeah, I remember those times as well. They were really fun missions.
So then if you fast forward to kind of my experience starting in 2007, the threat was more limited. Man-portable missiles and machine guns were kind of the things that we were worried about in Afghanistan. We'd start our day getting ready for the sortie about 3 hours prior to takeoff with briefings from the planning cell, intel, and the ground liaison, an Army representative, who would give us, you know, the best sense of what we could expect on the sortie. From there, we'd head over to aircrew flight equipment, you know, pick up our life jacket, survival gear, radios, etc. And then believe it or not, we would have to go through the host nation customs on the way out to the flight line. We actually went through customs before and after every sortie in those days.
You got to be kidding me.
No, unfortunately not. I think that was because we had a lot of airlift going through the ramp as well there, and so they were treating us all kind of the same through the same process.
Yes, I have a couple of Mark 82s to declare for this flight.
Yeah. Once we get out to the jet, we take off. You know, we're near our max allowable weight for the weather and runway length in those days. And then we'd go on what I like to call a long road trip with 3 of your closest friends. The B-1 cockpit might surprise you at how small it is. Despite the size of the jet, when you look at it from the outside, the interior portion is maybe about the size of a large SUV. Front and back seats are maybe a little bit further apart because they're connected by a small aisleway. But you'd load up, you know, go on this long road trip, and if somebody's lunch is particularly smelly, you're definitely going to know it. My sorties in those days were all about 12 to 14 hours, though other crews have flown much longer combat sorties, up to 24 hours in some cases, such as on days when the weather and country was preventing other air assets from flying, fighters, predators, army helicopters, et cetera, in country would potentially have different weather at their field than what we would from taking off outside Afghanistan. Now that's you know, a specific experience to OEF and Afghanistan. But I would say that in another situation, you might, or if you're talking more generally combat missions for the B1, you would see similar durations, but maybe flying in straight line distances instead of over a small geographic area.
So you're basically saying that you've got X amount of fuel on board. You can either burn that fuel going a long distance, or you can hold on station for a long period of time. And so bombers can flex that fuel either way, which is useful depending on what the commander wants.
Right, exactly. We were able to take gas a couple of times and then provide, you know, that long persistence overhead.
So what makes you different than other types of aircraft we might see in the airspace, you know, like the F-15E, F-18, or the F-16?
Well, the B-1 does bring some unique and complementary capabilities. So often we'd work together with some of these other aircraft. Personally, I worked MQ-1s, MQ-9s, U-28s, AC-130s were some of the more common ones that I'd worked with. But there were some other NATO aircraft that I'd worked with. I worked with Mirages a couple times, and seeing those Delta wings flying around is a pretty unique sight.
So, Moses, when you say work with, who are you actually talking to? Who's in charge? Are you talking to the operators flying the remotely piloted aircraft? Are you talking to the guys in the cockpits of the AC-130s? Or who are you actually coordinating with?
Right. So, generally, we're all working with the same Joint Terminal Attack Controller, or JTAC. So that individual will be on the ground, embedded with the ground unit, or at their headquarters, and they control all the aircraft on station. Usually, they stack us up and try to use each aircraft's strengths and unique capabilities.
Yeah, so almost like an air traffic controller in many ways, just in a combat environment.
Right. I think it was General Mosley who had dubbed the B-1 the roving linebacker in those days when he was the CFAC. And what he was getting at for our unique combination of assets or capabilities was our persistence, our range and speed, and payload. So when I say persistence, the B-1's out there, they're not taking gas every hour like some of the other fighter type aircraft might, and we can stay on station for a long time. That gives you a lot of options because in that area of the world, a lot of times the weather is really bad, and so everybody is carrying divert gas and keeping their tanks relatively full all the time. And while the Reaper and Predator are the kings of persistence, they're faster than a helicopter, but they're not particularly quick compared to other fixed-wing aircraft. So if something happened in an unexpected place in Afghanistan and you needed to get there quickly, it's fairly large. It's about the size of Texas. So the B-1's range and speed meant that something popped up in the far north or western part of the nation, who had the legs and the speed to get there and respond quickly, often that was the B-1.
All right, so give me an idea of speed. How fast are you guys going from one of those kind of taskings to the next?
Well, we would normally travel at our max range type airspeeds just to be conservative with gas. But if there was a crisis, a troops in contact type event on the ground, we would transit even supersonic if necessary.
Wow, that's impressive.
The other thing the B-1 brings is a large payload, lots of bombs. I'd say probably about 4 fighters worth, depending on which type of fighter you're talking about and the specific loadout. There's, you know, a lot of variability there. We also had a pretty good air-to-ground radar, so we could look for vehicles and other radar-significant things in poor weather when maybe the targeting pod wasn't helping. Sometimes we'd follow a convoy with our radar and try to provide them awareness of traffic jams or other vehicles on the road ahead of them and just try to provide them that security. But in combination, you know, those capabilities bring the planners at the Air and Space Operations Center, or the KAOC, a lot of flexibility. For example, on carrier recovery days, which I think was their weekly maintenance period, when they're repairing catapults, arresting gear, et cetera, the KAOC would ask us to plus up the schedule with an extra B-1 sortie and or extend the other B-1 sorties that day to get an equivalent number of hours of close air support coverage, basically trying to replace those several Hornet 2 ships that weren't on the schedule. It's not an exact one-to-one, since those two ships would have brought a second pod, 2 guns, et cetera, but it definitely helped reduce risk to the ground forces during those gaps.
I'm going to hop in here to insert a little commentary. For people that say bombers are expensive, it's really important to think about what Moses just said. You know, you got a B-1 replacing an entire carrier air wing in terms of combat effectiveness, and it's really important to think about when we're looking about investment decisions. So now let's swing the conversation a different way. What makes the B-1 different than the B-52 or the B-2?
Well, we certainly have a lot in common. Each of the bombers were designed with similar nuclear and conventional roles, but there's still, you know, differences and nuances to each mission. For example, the B-2 was designed for stealth and as a result has some big advantages in that arena. It can also carry 2 of the 30,000-pound class massive ordnance penetrators. And, never having had that experience, that just seems like it must be a crazy ride to have your jet suddenly shed 60,000 pounds of weight in seconds.
So bring us up to speed here. For that weapon, are you going after a bunker, or what would that kind of bomb be used for? Because it sounds huge.
Yeah, it would be against hard and deeply buried targets. And I think when Ghost and Crank were on a few weeks ago, they gave you an awesome rundown of B2 operations. But on the other hand, they only exist in limited numbers. There's only about like 20 airframes. On the other hand, the B-52, you know, there were like almost 800 of those built originally. And their external carriage gives it a lot of flexibility, especially with large external weapons like the CALCOM and ALCOM. But they only have a single internal bomb bay, which, while it carries those large or long weapons, limits the number of smaller JDAM or JASM that it could carry internally compared to the B-1. Just one small anecdote, though. When I was deployed to Guam, we shared the island with a B-52 and B-2 squadron for a couple of weeks. While we were planning some of our joint missions, we were seeing firsthand that while the B-1 and B-52 were kind of in the same ballpark in terms of miles per gallon of fuel used, we could carry more of those 2,000-pound class weapons if you were counting weapons per gallon. But at the same time, they had something like 20%, maybe 25% more internal fuel. So, you know, you're looking at the fuel card, and it makes you a little bit jealous to look at the fuel plan and realize that, you know, they have a pretty robust pad for bad weather or contingencies.
Just to clarify, when you're talking about different loadouts and all that, there is actually a lot more variation here. I mean, a lot of this is dependent on the kind of racks that are installed and what has been budgeted for. So you could change configurations a lot more if people want to invest in the bomb bay, because it's just a big open box, right?
Yeah, to some extent. Their bomb bay is a lot longer rotary launcher that's carried in there, which gives them that flexibility with the ALCOM and CALCOM like I was talking about. But really, the big flexibility of external carriage is something the B-1 hasn't had in a while, though they are doing some tests on that front, and maybe that will be something we see in the future. But to get back to you know, what makes the B-1 different, obviously it's the fastest and obviously the best looking. But more seriously, having three bomb bays does bring us some unique flexibility. So the forward two bays were originally designed to be combined into one for those long weapons like the CALCOM, and that went away in the 90s after the START treaty. But while that meant that we couldn't carry that kind of weapon, having those as two separate bays lets us double up on 2,000-pound class weapons. So we can carry quite a bit more of today's stealthy cruise missiles, like the Joint Air-Surface Standoff Missile, the Long-Range Anti-Ship Missile, than either of the other two bombers. There's some other, you know, minor differences that may, you know, still matter to planners. The B-1 has a standard tricycle gear that allows us to operate from slightly narrower runways and taxiways than the B-52 might with its outrigger landing gear. We don't have a drogue chute for landing, which changes some considerations there. And, you know, potentially important, with the B-1 having a conventional-only mission, it may change your strategic messaging options if that's part of the consideration for employment.
So one of the mission attributes we often talk about when discussing Iraq and Afghanistan is the notion of real-time targeting, and it was pretty revolutionary when it occurred. Can you walk us through that process?
Yeah, this was one of the things that I was fortunate enough to kind of witness a lot of it firsthand. My first deployment in 2007, the jet was radar only for sensors. Well, that and eyeballs and maps. But our targeting info would come from that JTAC that we were talking about earlier via voice. You know, we had coordinate-seeking weapons in the form of JDAM, and we'd use our radar to correlate the target coordinate with the JTAC's description. But in terms of onboard sensors, you know, we're only seeing large things with the radar. The next year, when I deployed again, this time we were the first B-1 squadron to carry the sniper pod into combat. While the year before, you know, maybe I could only see, like, you know, some large buildings or riverbeds, large features like that. Now we could see people, vehicles, you know, in much more detail both day and night. And, you know, even better, the JTACs, a lot of them had the ability to watch a live feed of the sniper pod. So now you could really talk about the same thing real time. And flash forward a couple years after my time at the FTU and the weapons school, I got to be part of another B-1 first, the first deployment with laser JDAM. And this really closed the loop on that real-time targeting, because now we had a weapon that had a seeker that you could guide to a mobile or moving target. But I would say even more important to that was the software updates that came with it. So believe it or not, the first versions of the targeting pod and aircraft, you know, from 2007 timeframe and on, were running it through a laptop. It didn't have a way to feed the coordinate directly into the weapon. It was machine to machine, but there was, you know, human button pushing involved, and a manual process.
So you've got Ronald Reagan's bomber here running off a modern-day laptop that's kind of kludged in here. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of innovation and innovative tactics and hardware kind of being put together at the same time to bring this capability to bear. And then by this time, in 2012, now we had this new software block that allowed us to turn the laser on, designate a location as a target, and those coordinates would stay live and continue to update in the system while that laser's on. So it really reduced the timeline even further.
Well, Moses, I don't have to tell you that clearly operations over Iraq and Afghanistan were permissive airspace, and we didn't have to worry about getting shot down by surface-to-air missiles or an enemy fighter. And the sanctuary airspace probably isn't going to exist when we move to a scenario with China, Russia, Iran, or North Korea. So how does that affect the way in which you can execute missions in the future? Do you feel like the B-1 is more of a standoff aircraft in these scenarios?
Well, if you're talking about one of those areas turning into a crisis or conflict, yeah, we definitely would expect a different scenario. While I was saying earlier, we did worry about small arms and machine guns and to some extent man-portable heat-seeking missiles. There really wasn't a huge threat in terms of surface-to-air missiles after 2003. So to get to your question of standoff for the future, I'd say yes and no. I guess the training focus will trend more that way, with standoff being the weapon of choice as more capable missile systems and SAMs are proliferating. But I think there's still going to be a need for stand-in, and the B-1's maneuverability and defensive suite will allow that, not everywhere, but in some target areas away from the newest threat systems, or maybe after the defenses have been degraded by other standoff weapons or fifth-gen platforms.
So just to clarify, what would drive the requirement if you were going to stand off or stand in?
I'd say the big driver is going to be your level of risk that is acceptable for the scenario, and what that is going to depend on is the defensive systems and the target, and you have to balance the capability of the airplane versus what is defending that target area. But if I were to speculate about the types of scenarios that you're describing, the numbers of targets could be huge. Mitchell and the Hudson Institute had a paper not that long ago that talked about some estimates of numbers of targets that you could be talking, but my thought would be that as much as you might want to shoot a standoff weapon at everything, whether that's cruise missiles or hypersonics in the future, there's probably going to be more targets than missiles of all sorts. And, while it's not an exact comparison, and this happened while I was out of the jet on my staff tour, the Tigers dropped 5,037 plus one JDAM in a 6-month deployment in 2015 to Syria. One of the Strike Eagle squadrons dropped almost as many in the neighborhood of 5,000 weapons in the same time frame. So when you're talking about the numbers of targets that could be required to be serviced, even in a small conflict like that against ISIS, you're going to need some options to provide that volume of firepower.
Okay, so a lot of what you're talking about is also the cost of the weapon, where standoff can cost double-digit millions, and there's just limitations with that, with how many you have in the inventory versus the guided munition that you drop from overhead could be, like double-digit thousands instead.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's really about using the right tool for the job and, using the standoff weapon when you need to for the threat that's defending that target area.
So in that vein, we've heard the B-1 is being considered as a lead candidate for fielding air-launched hypersonic missiles. Can you talk about why this is a significant development?
I'd say that certainly current standoff weapons are a big enabler. I saw a PA press release recently with pictures of B-1 using its external pylons to carry and release a weapon, which looks pretty cool from my perspective. The B-1 can already carry quite a few of those standoff cruise missiles, but they're relatively slow in comparison to the types of things that we're hearing, are on the near horizon. And external carriage is going to be the thing that opens the door for the B-1 community to either bring more of today's cruise missiles or potentially carry those hypersonic weapons that are in development. My understanding is that those hypersonic weapons are really going to take the standoff mission to another level. They're going to greatly diminish the time of flight, potentially add more range, and my understanding is really going to improve your ability to penetrate defenses.
So it's all about getting to targets that might be moving around. So you want to get to it while it's in a given spot when your intel lines up with it, and that's about getting through the defenses.
Yeah, absolutely. So, one thing we talk about during mission planning is, if the targets are valuable enough for us to attack them, the enemy is probably also going to value them enough to defend them. So they're going to, you know, put those defensive systems in place, and having an air-launched hypersonic weapon where you can, you know, potentially reroute and avoid those threats, or, you know, give the weapon more survivability against the defensives because your launch location is going to be harder to predict. It can give you some capabilities to mass forces that maybe would be tough to do with other types of platforms.
So from a training perspective, what does this increased focus on higher end conflict mean for B-1 crews?
So I would say as we shift focus, we'll see more standoff weapons training, like we talked about before. But I think also seeing a contested electromagnetic environment, whether that's contested or degraded data link, communications, or GPS, you know, is another area where we're going to continue to see more training. Although on one hand, the B-1 was originally designed without GPS, so in some ways that's, you know, what's old is new again in terms of training. In my opinion, a lot of what we'll focus on in the future will be further development of how we can integrate forces within the AOR. For example, the integration of LRASM, that long-range anti-ship missile, into operations not just with the U.S. Navy, but allies and partners, will be something I think we'll see in the future.
So what you're saying is, for sea control and all, you don't just need to use another ship. An airplane can really be effective, considering you can cover tons of territory really fast.
Yeah. I think we'll see, like you've probably heard or read some of the concepts about using 4th-gen and 5th-gen fighters together to use the 5th-gen sensors in concert with the expanded magazine of 4th-gen fighters. I think you would be able to see that with air-launched weapons in conjunction with, you know, a DDG or cruiser. They've got big magazines, but it's going to be really tough for them to reload, especially in conflict. And they have to balance their offensive missions with other missions like ballistic missile defense, air defense, something that they can only do. You know, the B-1's not going to do either one of those, unfortunately. So I think you'll see some concepts where the B-1 can bring essentially what's a 5th-gen weapon and bring those in large numbers and really expand the ways a joint task force can operate when you start thinking about, you know, how you might prioritize the standard missiles and TLAMs that are in that, you know, joint task force. And really the key to that, in my opinion, is going to be some of these joint all-domain C2 concepts and advanced battle management system, which is really going to be the key to unlocking those capabilities of targeting.
Right. Now, I understand that B-1 underwent a series of upgrades in recent years, you know, especially with the cockpit and the radar. Can you walk us through what that means from a capability perspective?
Sure. I'll give it a shot. So most of my career was pre-data link. This latest upgrade is going to give us glass cockpit displays, upgraded radar components, so we have a little bit higher resolution with our ground mapping. And we can now see that map at each crew station. So there's a lot more information sharing that previously would have just been going on via voice. But the biggest change was the integration of data link and the display of its data, both line of sight and beyond line of sight. So a lot of evolution to the platform in the last 20 years. And a lot of that innovation has occurred both in hardware and in the tactics of using that new hardware.
So Moses, what I'm hearing from you is it gets you off of voice with radio to transmit different information and have it go from machine to machine.
Yeah.
So can you walk us through a day in your life as a squadron commander? You know, if memory serves me right, there are only about 5 operational B-1 squadrons in the Air Force. So this is a pretty unique assignment, I can imagine. And what are some of the unique demands you saw your team juggling as a high-demand, low-density armor of the Air Force?
Well, it was certainly an honor to be entrusted with a combat squadron, you know, and I can't really even tell you how great it was to get an additional year with the Tigers as their DO first. But like you're saying, it is a really small community. I would say, you know, as a slight correction, effectively, we only have 3 combat squadrons besides the test, weapons school, and the schoolhouse. I say effectively 3 because there are two squadrons, 1 active and 1 reserve, that are paired up, but they're sharing the same number of aircraft as the other 2 combat squadrons. So you end up with the equivalent of about 3. In terms of the challenge of being a high demand, low density asset, I'd say one of the biggest changes recently, and a positive one, I think, was the transition from 2 semi-permanent forward locations to the bomber task force concept, which is more dynamic.
So walk us through that. With the location, now this isn't out of Guam, right? So you guys literally just go out there to be a permanent presence in the Pacific for a couple of months and then rotate home. And now you're talking about flying around the world in a more dynamic fashion.
Right. Like you're getting at, between 2001 and about through 2019, the B-1s and the B-52s between them were maintaining a presence both in the Middle East at Al Udeid and in Guam almost nonstop. Most of that time, the B-1 squadrons were on a 2-to-1 dwell with 12 months at home, followed by 6 months deployed to the Middle East. So that, you know, caused a couple challenges. It's pretty grueling pace, both on the hardware and the airmen that maintain and operate them. I'll give you, you know, for a sense of that scale, the B-1 surpassed 10,000 combat sorties in 2012 on one of my deployments, which is pretty impressive considering that Desert Fox and Allied Force prior to that only constituted about 100 sorties or so. The rest of that 10,000 all was since October of 2001. And the pace didn't let up after the 10,000 sortie. The B-1 stayed in CENTCOM through 2016, then rotated to the Pacific for 18 months, and then returned to CENTCOM for about another 13 months. And while I don't know the exact number today, I'd be willing to bet you that we're about 15 or 16,000 sorties in combat and something like 200,000 combat hours spread across three squadrons worth of people and jets.
Wow, that's really impressive. When you think about it, it's just a few people carrying a really big load.
It is. And the work the maintainers do in those deployed environments to make the sorties happen 7 days a week, 365 days a year is really nothing short of awe-inspiring. But I would say that continuous commitment to, you know, single location and one mission set was also limiting the Air Force's flexibility to use the B-1 to respond in other combatant commands AORs.
So what you're saying is there's a lot of global demand for bombers. It's not only the Pacific.
For sure. In the last year or so, you know, we've seen press releases and headlines of B-1s deploying to or participating in exercises in India, Norway, Guam, the Netherlands, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, other places. The range and flexibility of bombers and the B-1 allows them to be responsive around the globe with the bomber task force, which was tougher in the old construct when two squadrons were tied down at these permanent locations. Well, I'll give you one personal example of this bomber task force construct. So in the fall and winter of 2019, you know, you probably remember things were getting tense in the Middle East. There were Iranian attacks on Saudi oil refineries. An Iranian ship was hit by rockets or a mine, I believe. And one night while I'm at home making dinner, I got a call from my group commander, get into the OSS vault. You know, the next thing I know, I'm packing some tan uniforms and on my way to catch a commercial flight to Riyadh to help catch the B-1s that are arriving into Prince Sultan Air Base for the first time. Now, the bombers could have beaten me there, but it was nice to have some time to get the lay of the land, sort out parking, fuel, and some of those administrative logistics things, you know, just in the nick of time. And a week later, the B-52s, who had already been forward deployed to the Fairford in the UK, dropped in as well to keep up the strategic messaging and help cool things down in the region.
I appreciate you bringing that personal perspective. Now, I'm really hearing that you guys are a rapid reaction force, so that if we want to send a signal to reassure our allies or deter adversaries, you guys are a huge part of that. And that's going to create some big headlines and send a strong signal. So it's kind of peace through strength.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, the B-1 started with a buy of about 100 aircraft, but the Air Force now has less than half of that in service, and this all occurred while the demand for the type was on the rise. So what does this mean regarding wear and tear on the aircraft, the air crews, and the maintainers?
Yeah, you're right. The demand signal certainly has been high in my time in the B-1, and that op tempo creates a lot of work for the maintainers to keep the airplanes up, and it's a busy time on the road for the air crews as well. And while playing this roving linebacker role can be busy, with the number of squadrons at home in the U.S., I think that's, you know, maybe a way to communicate the mission versus the size of the force. The Air Force's 2018 report on the force we need said we're about 5 squadrons short of bombers for the amount of mission that we have. So while maybe that doesn't sound like a huge number, you know, fighter squadron numbers are, I think, around 55, for the bomber force, that's a huge percentage. It would mean that we need to grow more than 50%. And so as we see the B-21 coming online, that's one of the things that makes me hopeful that we'll see a size of force and a number of squadrons proportionate to the mission need.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And we really agree with that. And it's been a huge Mitchell imperative for quite some time now. You know, after 4 decades of service under its belt, the B-1 is going to be replaced by the B-21 in the 2030s. And obviously the B-21 is a highly classified program. And we obviously understand its overreaching elements like stealth and advanced communications. But can you speak to other things that you think it might bring to the fight?
Well, I'll give it a shot. I've been excited, you know, reading the press reports about the B-21 because I don't have any insider info on it, much to my own disappointment. But I still am super curious about what that's going to mean, you know, as a fellow bomber aviator. It'll be a sad day when the B-1 leaves the flight line, but I think the B-21 is going to bring some of the similar capabilities to current bombers in terms of range and payload. Stealth, while that would be new to me in my B-1 background, maybe not as big a surprise to the current B-2 pilots in the Air Force. But some of the big changes that I think we'll see with the B-21 is, you know how we were talking earlier about the flow of information from the targeting pod to a weapon and how those incremental changes had brought, you know, a big revolution to the B-1. Now imagine the potential of fully integrated onboard and offboard data when it's designed that way from the beginning, like they talk about ABMS being baked into the B-21. It sounds like a real game changer.
Yeah, in many ways, it sounds like going from a flip phone to a smartphone.
Yeah, and that ability to fuse your information from your different sensors onboard and offboard sounds like it's going to be a way to find that needle in the haystack that really isn't possible with 1970s and 1980s hardware. Another thing that I think will be a big game changer that maybe isn't as obvious is, you know, you've probably seen recently the articles about how the B-1 was, or one of the B-1s was brought out of AMARG down at Davis-Monthan so that the Air Force could build a digital twin, and how much that was going to provide maintenance data and some analysis results, even in the remaining life cycle of an airplane that was built in the 1980s. So just imagine having that built into the digital development and engineering from the beginning and what that can provide to the B-21 in the future.
Now you bet. And when you think about it, this is the first time we've really had new bomber requirements since the early 1980s, and that's just a huge game changer. And Moses, we really appreciate having you here on the Aerospace Advantage. It's always great to hear from someone who has significant operational experience like you do, and we really want to say thanks for you being part of the Mitchell team this year. We really appreciate everything.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a great opportunity that the Air Force allowed me to take this academic year at a think tank over the past year. But I could not have asked for a better place to be than to be at one that is focused on aerospace power like you are here at Mitchell. Thanks.
It's been an honor. Thank you. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.